You're listening to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, bringing class to trash since 1977.
Everybody, welcome to the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. We are back, and this week, a little bit of a special episode. Will and I could not get our... I feel like we've said this several times over the years, but, you know, it just happens with Will and I. We both have young children, and things come up. So, we could not make our schedules combine, communicate, collate. I don't know what word. I'm just looking for words at this point. So I had to go to the bench. I went to the bench to grab my dear friend, Troy from the Not a Bomb podcast. Troy, how you doing?
I'm great. I didn't know we were going to record a podcast. All the message said was, do you want to jump on video and talk about like two sweaty guys hitting each other for 2 hours? I'm like, I am all in. Yeah, I mean, if you want to turn this into a podcast episode, I'm all for it.
I mean, yeah, that's pretty normal for us talking about sweaty men punching each other.
That's a day's worth of text right there.
Yeah, that's not uncommon at all. As a matter of fact, I hope we haven't used up all of our material in previous conversations for this show, but we'll get to that. So we are going to discuss Roadhouse from 2024, the reboot, remake, reimagining, again, using all these fancy words, my thesaurus is handy. For a new modern take on Roadhouse. It premiered on Amazon Prime this past week. We got some other stuff, obviously, Will and I scheduled. I know this is kind of a last-minute thing. But this one's kind of got the some of the fan groups, including ours, a little... Some folks not so happy, some folks meh, some folks pretty happy. So when you get that much of a response, it's kind of worth talking about, I think. So I thought... You know, who the master of loving kicks to the face is with me. And this is a good time to talk about this, right?
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, I participate in the Gentleman's Guide forums and everything else. I got to be honest, I was really surprised at all of the different reactions to this film. So when you said, hey, do you want to talk about this thing? I'm like, absolutely. Because I actually find the reaction just as fascinating as the film itself, to be quite honest.
It is. It was, I'm not going to say shocking, because I think I was just surprised at how all over the map it was. I expected some responses that were said, and we'll get to that here in a little bit when we do the review, but some I did not at all. And I think it's worth talking about for a couple reasons, so we'll get to that in a little bit. So that's what we're going to be talking about. Let's see here. Normally we do feedback here, but Will's not here, and I don't want to – you guys that have sent feedback in, I do not want to waste your feedback in case you wanted to hear Will's northernly laugh or his response to your feedback. So I'm going to save it until he comes back. Apologies, but I got it. Don't worry. Paul, I know you're out there. This is a little joke between me and Paul right now. I know how you feel about Roadhouse. We'll discuss that when Will comes back. But it's not that Paul either. It's Red Waffle Paul. There's another Paul.
Okay. There's another Paul that has a very strong opinion on this thing.
Yeah. Which we'll talk about that too. So let's just get into what we've been watching and we'll go from there and we'll just have some fun. Sound good?
Sounds great.
All right, man. What have you been watching?
Well, I think you know what I've been watching because I share it with you every time I watch it.
This is true, but our listeners don't. I know pretty much everything you watch, yes.
That's true. So, as you know, Cameron and I are doing this little adventure where, for whatever reason, we're just watching a lot of dumb comedies lately. So I'm gonna group these together, maybe single out one, just because I think it pertains to the movie we're going to talk about tonight. Mm-hmm. But this week, I mean, we actually had a pretty good run. We started with Corky Romano. Now, the only reason why I thought we should watch this one is that that one scene when he dresses up as a Girl Scout and rings the doorbell and just says, "You want some Girl Scout cookies?" or something like that. And I laugh every time at that thing. I think the rest of the movie is just...
You know, that moment's
so weird.
Yeah, it is a weird movie. That moment's funny, but that also reminds me of the Tim Curry moment in Loaded Weapon 1.
Yes.
Where he brings the door one and like, "We're doing this, girls."
But yeah, you want to buy some cookies? I laugh every time. But then there is another sequence. I mean, it's such an odd film to have. Was it Chris Penn?
Yes.
And Peter Berg? And it just a weird cast.
Yes.
But I was surprised how much I did laugh during this film. And then the other sequence that really cracks me up is when he's all jacked up on cocaine talking to the kids. And he's like, "You got to quit. But the reason why we've been watching these films is my son's reaction, because he's 18 with like a, I don't know, 13-year-old personality. He's cracking up during this whole thing.
Sure,
so
sure.
We watched that. We watched the first three Scary Movie films, which I think are pretty underappreciated, especially that third one. I do have a lot of fun with those.
I do like those three, yes.
Yeah, and then we topped off our little marathon that he and I were doing with Bubble Boy, because I had never seen Bubble Boy.
Yeah.
And he is a huge Jake Gyllenhaal fan, so we had a blast with that one. I was really surprised how good, A, Jake was in that, and B, how much I did laugh. I mean, that is something that I definitely think we might end up talking about on Not a Bomb. So that was sort of our comedic run. And then I switched over to, for whatever reason, I keep thinking that Soldier came out first, but this other film did, and they're kind of the same film, but it's Mario Van Peebles solo.
Yeah, they are kind of the same film.
Yeah, and I don't know why it was in my head. I always thought Solo was sort of a carbon copy of Soldier, but Soldier came out after Solo, and Solo is another one of those films that it's just brainless, goofy fun. It does, in my opinion, make one cardinal sin, and it has flippies, like people doing flips for no reason when people are shooting at them. Which kind of annoys me. I don't mind flippies when there's face kicking. But other than that, it's a pretty enjoyable watch.
My brother and I, when we were younger and that came out, we were like, "I'm going to see a movie." And they're like, "What?" "I'm going alone. It's going to be Solo." We thought that was funny at the time.
That's a pretty good dad joke.
Yeah, even then, at a young age, before I was a father, I was already making bad dad jokes.
Yeah, no, it was a fun revisit. And then... two other films. I think I was texting you while I was watching this one because I had kind of forgot how horny this film was. But it was, I think, 1990s Internal Affairs with Richard Gere. And that movie should have just been called Horny Cops, because that's all it is.
It is a horny cop movie, yes. There's a part of me that's always enjoyed that movie because Richard Gere is such a jerk in that movie. It's unbelievable how much of a jerk he is.
Yeah, and I mean, it's actually got a pretty stacked cast with him, Andy Garcia, Laurie Metcalf, Nancy Travis is in it. I mean, it is kind of that swarmy 90s film noir, you know, sex thriller.
Isn't that, what's that director? Is that...
Mike Figgis.
Yeah, that's right. Mike Figgis, of all people.
Yeah, it was a fun 90s revisit.
Whatever happened to Mike Figgis?
Yeah, you should go back and watch it. But like I said, it really should be called Horny Cops the movie, because that's
you could even call it Anal Cops if you wanted to.
Yeah, you could.
There's one scene where it's like, oh, well, there you go.
Yes, it does get there. But I got to say, the highlight of the week is something that Cam and I went to see. I think it's limited engagement. It's going to show up on Shudder in mid-April. But we did sneak out to see to a pretty much sold out theater, which surprised me. But we caught Late Night with the Devil, which was just fantastic. Like, Shudder of late has been doing a lot of great stuff. And I love the fact that some of these films are getting just a very limited theatrical release. But if you have a subscription, and definitely when this thing hits, I highly recommend it.
Yeah,
we loved it. And I love the fact that it is getting so much love from either, you know, from other filmmakers like Paul Schrader, et cetera, who wrote a really interesting, you know, piece on it. But I'm not even going to just try to pronounce his last name because I would slaughter it. But it's David Dalmachian. You know who I'm talking about?
Dalmachian?
Is that how you say it?
Something like that. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, he's phenomenal. I mean, I've always liked him as an actor, but this is 100% his film. And I really appreciate that it kind of takes its time. It's not a jump scare film. It really amps up the dread. I think some people have a problem with the ending, but I really like it. And it was one of those films that after it was over, Cameron and I, you know, talked about it quite a bit. And I was really surprised how many little details they lay out in the beginning of the film that pay off towards the end of it. And it has some pretty effective shocks, but it's just a really effective, creepy film. And surprisingly, it has a heart in the central character that David, you know, plays. But yeah, I highly recommend that thing. I mean, it's one of those I was a little worried because this time last year, everybody was, you know, raving about Skinamarink. And we went and saw that in the theater. And I was very upset.
Yes.
But this time, it was a good theater experience. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, you always worry about those kind of zeitgeist movies, right?
Yeah. It's, you know, especially when people in our community get really excited about it. You almost want to, you know, is that hyperbole or is it really that good? And I can say from my perspective, it's as good as everybody is saying it is.
Nice. That's good to hear. It's good to hear. I typically don't like that kind of material, but I like the idea behind this one. So we'll see. I'm going
to
check it out.
Yeah. I mean, the whole premise of it trying to be a film during the filming of a late night talk show, you wonder how effective can they pull off that gimmick without it feeling like a gimmick?
Yeah.
But the way they do it and the way they film it and even how they go from black and white to color during certain aspects of the film really add to it feeling like you're there behind the scenes and you're also part of the audience watching this whole, you know, thing unfold. So a lot of great creative choices that I think pay off. And again, it's just a really spooky, effective film.
Yeah. Nice. I'm looking forward to checking it out. Probably will not see it in theaters here because it's not really, you know, this area, not really something that's going to run across, but obviously I will see it on Shudder and I got a pretty good sound system. I'll be okay. So I'll be able to check it out.
Yeah. You'll love it. I'm curious what you think of it, but I got a feeling you're going to like it a lot.
All right. I'm looking forward to it. All right. Is that everything?
That's everything.
All right. Cool. I got a few things I can talk about. I don't know what I left off with when I was talking to Will, but I'll talk about a few things here. I was talking with, well, in our text message thread we have, Jose brought up the new Scream, and I thought, well, now's the best time just to check out Scream 4. Just rip the Band-Aid off. Check it out. I checked out after Scream 3. I was pretty much done with it. I was like, okay, I'll check out Scream 4. I don't know if I'll check out Scream 5 and 6. I really didn't like Scream 4.
Oh, really?
I just really didn't like. I mean, it's okay. I don't know. I just didn't really care for it that much. Okay.
Did it feel just like a retread, or
yeah,
was
it just
there
felt
just
like
something?
It just felt like a retread. It just felt kind of empty in a way. I like the cast. Most everybody's pretty good in the film. I like some of the ideas, but I didn't really like the twist. So
the twist,
yeah, the twist, the twist. I didn't really like it. I checked out a film on the recommendation of our good friend, Mr. Randy.
Uh-oh.
This was something he texted me solo on. So you know when he texts you solo, he really means for you to check it out, right?
And seriously, that guy bats 1,000 in my book.
Yeah.
I mean, when he gets excited about something, I get excited about it. So
yeah, when he sends something my way, I'm like, well, I got to put that on the queue and I got to bump it up.
Yeah.
So he told me to check out Dream Scenario with Nicolas Cage.
Oh, yeah.
For a, because I had talked about Beau Is Afraid and how that movie just made me cringe the whole way through. Just feel awkward and uncomfortable. This movie also made me feel awkward and uncomfortable all the way through. I don't think it nails it as much as Beau Is Afraid does. I think it does some interesting things that Beau Is Afraid takes way too long to do. And I think it's got some interesting ideas. But when people say Nick Cage doesn't take chances and doesn't do things, I'm like, look, he makes a lot of films, and I know you probably don't see them all, but dig around and look for the gems in there, because the guy can still act. The guy can still do the things he can do. And man, he made me so uncomfortable in this movie the entire time. And it's a pretty fun performance in that way. The movie kind of hits or misses a little bit on some things, but I'm really glad I checked it out. It has some, oh my God, just some moments, like moments that are so awkward, like I don't even ever see me watching it with my children ever.
Oh, okay.
I was
he
just
didn't
like,
say that. Yeah. I was with him this weekend, and he brought that movie up, and it was like, yeah, I'll definitely check that out. But now hearing your reaction to it, yeah. It's got to get pushed up.
Yeah. I watched something called The Royal Hotel. I've been tracking this one for a while. This one's about two ladies who lose most of their money. Well, they're in Bali, and they lose their money, and they need to get money to get back home. They're traveling abroad. They're in Australia. And they get in touch with this work program that can get them a job in this remote area of the outback. And they can bartend there. So already you're thinking to yourself, well, this sounds like the setup of an exploitation movie for sure. And this certainly has the feel of an exploitation movie. I don't think this is, as we often joke and Jose says, and I don't think it's entirely successful for what it's trying to do, but it is a film that makes you feel rather uneasy the whole time. The male gaze is really awkward and uncomfortable and threatening. And I think the film is very well made. I would advise people check it out. It's on Hulu right now. And tied with that, there's actually a documentary out there that this film is kind of based on called Hotel Coolgardie. 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 Weird outback town name.
Okay.
And this is actually the true story of this bar where this kind of stuff. And as much as the movie tackles the suspense and stuff, this movie, this documentary, made me feel gross.
Gross. Okay.
Yeah, it's just the abuse these women take. They're two women from Finland. And the verbal abuse these women take and the male gaze that's real, because this is a documentary, and the awkwardness of men who are never around women hardly trying to hit on women. Oh my God. It is just so uncomfortable. And I just never felt at ease watching this documentary. And it's really just, it's not really a documentary about this situation as much as it's like a slice of life thing. It's like they put these two girls in there and chaos ensues. And it's just like, who in their right mind would even do this? It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable that this kind of behavior from people, I won't just say men, but from people still takes place to this day. Unbelievable. It's just,
it's so, is there such a thing as a transgressive documentary? I mean,
well,
is that
yeah,
what
I mean,
this is?
It is kind of a transgressive documentary. I mean, it's dealing with subject matter that, you know, people don't talk about. And it's uncomfortable. It really is. And, it's really worth a watch. The documentary is better than the film, but both of those pieces are good to watch. And I would recommend both of them to anybody. They're good watches. They're not make you feel good watches, but, they're good watches nonetheless. I watched, I got two more here. I watched, Freaknik, The Wildest Party I Never Told. This is our friend Brad actually posted there, sent this our way and said this was coming out. And I saw that pop up on Hulu and I checked it out. Pretty good. It doesn't deal with all the subject matter. Our good friend Josh, your good friend Josh as well, who's been on your show a few times. RRR himself, Josh. Yeah. He kind of hit me up on Facebook and kind of said, you know, what I felt too is they don't really talk about that. That festival got really dark and really weird and really aggressive and really ugly. They kind of gloss over it a little bit. And it's not that I needed the thrill of the darkness, but I think they kind of gloss over it a little too much. And it just feels a little strange the way they do it. It's pretty good, though. Not great. Not as good as Hotel Coolgardie. I would watch that one as opposed to this one. Last film I watched. So in the history of doing this show, what I've learned is that if a horror film comes out of Belgium, be careful.
Yeah, you've been talking about this one.
Yeah, be careful. Whatever it is about Belgium, it seems like this quaint, beautiful place where they make great chocolate and they have these old buildings and it's beautiful and everybody seems nice. But whatever it is about their horror films, there's some kind of twisted sense of darkness there that I don't understand. Their movies are, I mean, it's not a new thing. It's gone all the way back to, I think, a film we covered on the show, which was, we might have covered it. We might not have. I might have just talked about it, but it's a cult film called Lucker the Necrophagus. Necrophagus? Anyway, it's a movie about a guy that sleeps with dead people. And as dark as that sounds, it's made from Belgium, so it's even darker than you think it's going to be. And it goes all the way back to that. That's early 80s. That's back in the necromantic days. We all know, all of us cult movie fans know what necromantic is, even if we've never seen it.
Right.
Necromantic 1 and Necromantic 2. This movie is, it's not as dark as some films I've seen from Belgium, but maybe not as dark as like X-Drummer and a few other things, but man, it's still pretty dark. And there's some imagery here that they really have a knack for creating shocking imagery that really sticks with you. And at least it does for me. This is transgressive cinema. It's a very transgressive. I have no way of describing it except it's very wet, very disgusting, and possibly immoral.
Oh, okay.
No,
so that's a thumbs up, it sounds like.
Not possibly immoral. I'm going to say full on immoral. And okay. Wow. Yeah. I mean, it, again, we make the joke, it's not entirely successful with what it's trying to do, but it's entirely successful in repulsing me and making me feel kind of gross. And
is it that kind of repulsion that is trying to say something or make a point, or is it just how far can we take the medium?
You know, this question comes up sometimes because I often think of a Serbian film, which, you know, tried to say something, but also really pushed every button it possibly could push at the time.
Right.
And I don't feel like this film's trying to push every button. It's pushing a lot of them. It's like a kid in an elevator before the parent caught them. But it doesn't get them all. And I got to be honest with you, I don't know if this movie has a, I don't know if this film has a thesis.
Oh, okay.
I feel like it's just dark. It's just a dark, kind of twisted nightmare.
Yeah, I got to be honest. Like, those are the films that I've gotten to the point where it's like, if that's what you're coming to the table with, I don't know if I'm going to spend a lot of time with it. But if you're coming to the table with that and you're going to illuminate something on like human nature or have a thesis, I like that word thesis behind sort of your art. Mm-hmm. I'm all for it. Yeah. Like I want to be moved in that way, but I don't know. I don't know if it's like I'm an old man yelling at the skies going, I need something more than the gore anymore.
Well, I think you can take the route. So I think what Barbarian did well is I don't think Barbarian has a thesis either, but it mixes in some comedy and some over-the-top bizarreness that helps it get through what it is. So it turns into an entertainment.
Yeah, a little bit more mainstream, right?
Yes, a little bit more mainstream, although still quite dark and twisted. We can both agree.
Sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Barbarian's pretty, it's a pretty twisted little film. This one, it never feels like there's a moment of levity. It just feels like it's just hammering. In that sense that Belgian horror or Eastern European horror in particular, or just some of these films, they can just kind of put the pedal to the metal for making you feel like the world is a dark place. And it certainly is nihilistic. I'll say that. If there's one word that really describes this film outside of transgressive, it's nihilistic. It's certainly that. There's not a lot of positivity here. So it's not going to be for everybody. But what I will say is, if you're interested in visuals, it's worth a watch. Because it definitely has some visuals you'll never forget. I'll say that.
Okay. Okay.
But you got to be in the mood for something dark. Just to warn our warn our listeners. I laughed. I posted that. And some people are like, no, that's okay. You warned me on the last thing you warned me on. And I watched that. And I'm never watching that again. Like, well, I'm glad I'm here to help.
But That's fair.
But I had been tracking this one for a while. It's called Megalomaniac. Did I even say what it was called? I never even said what it was called. It's called Megalomaniac. Megalomaniac. It's on Shudder right now, so it's easily accessible. It's really weird. It has some sequences where it feels like it's shot made for TV. Like it literally like fades out and fades back in like really quickly, like a BBC television program.
Right.
And I have to believe that's an artistic choice. It's very odd. Because the movie starts out kind of with some threats in the background, kind of with some stuff going on, but in some ways kind of quaint, if kind of dark and dingy. And you think, okay, this is a terrible but simple life. And then one little thing happens after another, and you're like, this is going places that, I don't know if I expected them. I didn't expect it. I didn't expect to go where it went. So there you go. That'll probably make people watch it. I apologize to you in advance.
Now it's going to make me watch it. So yeah, that's exactly when you're like, you don't know where it's going. That's my kind of film.
Well, I mean,
I wouldn't be surprised.
You know, we watched, what was that Taiwanese film where we watched together? The gore film? What was it? The Sadness? Is that what it was?
Oh, The Sadness. Oh, yeah.
Randy recommended we watch. We watched that together. And I really like that film. I really did. But it's almost so aggressive that I don't know if I want to watch it again anytime soon. It's like,
oh,
it was such a punch in the face. It's like,
you know. I remember, so we watched that in the afternoon because we were cooking out and we went outside and I just stood in the sun for a little bit. Like I felt like I needed that after the film.
Yeah. We were all, I mean, we laughed at certain things because it's a gore film. And so there's moments where you laugh to kind of overcompensate for the gore, but it's also that movie's mean, man. That's a mean movie. That movie.
It is. I like the fact that, just our reaction made my son go, well, I got to go see this film. Then he watches it and he's like, oh, I got to show this to my friends. I'm like, they are going to think you're the weirdest kid ever.
I remember we were upstairs and they came up and they were talking about it. They were like, yeah.
Yeah. We like, told you. We warned you.
Yeah, we warned you. Just, you know. And for those who haven't seen The Sadness yet, you should definitely check it out. So,
yeah. There is one film you and I both watched this week together. That we're going to talk about over at Not a Bomb. So,
yeah. I was going to save it for the end, but we can talk about it now.
Yeah, I mean, we got to revisit Phantoms with Ben Affleck.
Yeah. That was interesting.
Rose McGowan.
That was an interesting revisit, I have to say.
It was a good conversation.
It was. We just recorded it last night. Yeah, we just recorded it last night, so it'll be out this week.
Yeah.
So I can't
check
wait.
It out.
Yeah. I can't wait for folks to check it out because
I can't wait to hear everybody's reaction to it. It's another one that I never expected there would be a large group of people who really love that film. Now yeah. We all had different opinions of it, which I thought made the conversation really good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's another one that kind of sort of has a little bit of a cult status, which sort of surprised me.
It does. It's built quite a following over the last 20 years, which is also just weird to say out loud.
Yeah, 100%. I would have never thought that when that thing came out.
No, but you know, that's the thing about cinema, right? And about films and pop culture. You really just never know, right?
Yeah.
And I always find the ones that amaze me the most are the ones I have a really visceral response to. Like, oh my God, I hated that film. And then it ends up in front of me 20-something years later. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute. This wasn't nearly as bad as I thought it was. And I always find that the most interesting because I'm like, where was I at that I hated it so much? Because I rarely hate anything, you know? So I don't know. I'm wondering if you'll have that response one day to Halloween Ends.
I don't think so. I think I'm of that age. I totally get what you're talking about because there's some films that I'll come across. I'm like, I'm not watching that again. But then somebody in the family wants to go see it. And then I'll watch it. And I'm like, oh, I really liked that film. Where was I in a headspace where I just had such a negative reaction to it versus now? But I can tell you right now, fuck David Gordon Green.
Because yeah, this is
that Halloween bullshit. No, absolutely not.
This is an ongoing subject to our listeners who don't know. This is FDGG is a comment that is frequented amongst four of us. The
yes.
Not a Bomb Classic crew, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is usually responded by me by saying, fuck Luc Besson.
Yeah, if we go back and forth all day on that one.
So there we go. Either way. Yeah, definitely check that out. If you want to hear more of me or if you just want to check out Not a Bomb, which I recommend you do. I love going over there. I love being on the show. Again, the only drawback to being on other people's podcasts is I can listen to it, but I don't listen to myself much. So I know it's a weird quirk. I don't know what's wrong with me. I know I'm pretty good at this at this point. I know I could.
Is it because you're sexually turned on by your own voice when you hear it?
It might be that I'm completely turned on by myself. Yes.
Okay. I thought I just assumed what it is because that's my problem when I listen to you.
Yeah. I didn't really want to share it, but
really, no. Hey, we're family.
Yeah.
We're family.
Pretty much. You know, I don't click like. I click love whenever I hear myself. You know.
So I get it. Yeah.
It's really tough. It's really tough. But no, I just do. I cringe when I hear myself. I don't know what that is.
That blows my mind because we've said this. I mean, you're one of the first podcasts I've ever done. I didn't even know what a podcast was until like Night of the Living Podcast and you guys. So
yeah.
the fact of how many podcasts are actually around because of what you and Will do.
Yeah.
And then to hear you make a comment like, man, I just can't listen to myself. I'm like, you've been doing this for so many years and you perfected it and yet you can't listen to yourself. That's crazy to me.
I know. It's insane. It clearly there, you know. And Troy, I'm just going to say it. There's something psychological there, and I don't know what it is, but I'm willing to work through it. Hopefully, one day.
No, I have to edit our shows, and it's painful because I'm like, why do I sound like this?
Yeah, I feel that way the whole time. Like, even if I'm like, hello, everybody, this is Sammy from the GGTMC.
Whoa, slow down. I just it's getting warm in here.
Like, if I just do like the warm, sexy voice, even I'll hear that, and I'll be like, So
that's not my react. Well, that is my reaction, but it's not what you think it is.
anyway. But yeah, check out Not a Bomb. We always push those guys anyway. And, you know, I couldn't get enough. I've been away too long. So I decided we make this joke on the new show, too. I decided to go back to back.
And you went back to back on two films that are entirely different.
Yes.
I mean, you couldn't have picked two more different films, which is kind of amazing.
People might wonder why I picked Phantoms, and I will not explain it here. I'll let you listen to the episode. They might wonder why.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's very easy. Let's just put it this way. It's very easy when people give you a list of films. It's much easier to pick films. I don't know if you feel this way, but if somebody gives you 10 movies to do to come on a podcast and guest on, you're almost immediately going to go to the one that you feel you can contribute to.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't think I could contribute anything to Phantoms, so I wanted to challenge myself.
Really?
That's one of the reasons why I picked it.
It's such a great conversation. I mean, I don't want to, like, everybody goes listen to it, is like, that was lame, but I had a lot of fun just because everybody had a different opinion on it, those are my favorite podcasts. I mean, I love it as an example when you and Will love a film. Don't get me wrong.
Sure.
But there's something about two people looking at something differently and, you know, they can still like the film, but come at it from a different place. That's to me why you listen to like a movie podcast.
Right, right. Oh, one more thing. I just finished watching right before we recorded. I just finished watching Eli Ross Thanksgiving.
No, you didn't. Was that the first time you saw it?
That was the first time I saw it, yeah.
Oh, so you liked it?
I like the effects.
Oh, okay.
I liked it. I liked it. I don't know. I'm not a filmmaker. Again, I've said this over the years, and I'll say it until I'm blue in the face. I don't make movies. I wish I did. I don't know if I'd be any good at it if I did. So, you know, really, who am I to judge? But there's just some things about it I thought were, I don't know. I guess the word I would use is something Will so often says, which I hear from Canadian critics quite a bit. It's the word obvious.
Okay.
There were some things that just felt a little too obvious to me. I did like what he did with the trampoline death. I like that he mixed that up. I like that.
Yeah.
Because the original one had the one very impactful, the trailer had the real impactful moment, which was great. But if he just went back to that, well, it wouldn't have worked. So I liked what he did there. And I liked the kills in the movie. The dumpster one was great. That came out of nowhere.
Right.
And I like the setup, the Black Friday setup. I like that. There's a part of me that I don't know if it's because I know a bunch of people from Boston. There's a part of me that always feels a little uncomfortable when I'm watching a bunch of people talk. Hey, come on, you fucking, what's wrong with you, you fucking weirdo? You know, it just, I don't know. It just, it's like, are we in a cartoon?
It does have the aesthetic of almost being a parody at times.
It does.
Yeah.
But I think some of it, look, it's not overly long. It was entertaining. I hate to admit this because I never like admitting this. This always is one of the worst things I hate when people say about movies. But I figured out who the killer was almost immediately.
Right. Yeah.
And that doesn't mean I'm a brainiac or a genius, because I'm not. I usually don't figure that stuff out. I really don't. But this one, I think it's way, I think the way he sets it up, it's a little too obvious for me. So
that
was a problem. But I like that twist either way. I thought it was a nice touch. I won't go into any further detail for those who haven't seen it. And again, I'll say the practical effects were nice. It's nice to see practical effects.
The big question now that you've seen it is, when Turkey Day rolls around this year, are you going to watch Thanksgiving or Thanksgiving?
Well, I'm just going to flat out tell you that I think Thanksgiving is much more entertaining than Thanksgiving.
Okay. I would agree with you. Thanksgiving, yeah. I was surprised how much fun I had when we watched that one.
Thanksgiving might be better made, but Thanksgiving has more spirit.
Yes. And it has a turkey with those glasses and the fake nose and a mustache. So.
Yeah.
I'm in right there.
Playing her dad. Oh, yeah. Yes, honey. Yes, honey. Come on in.
Come on in, honey.
It's okay. Also has a turkey rape scene. And
he used protection, though.
That's not a turkey being raped. That's a turkey doing the raping.
Yeah.
That's
truly transgressive.
To say the least, yes.
Turkey-gressive.
But yeah. But I like Thanksgiving. I was going to kind of save that for Will in a way, because I think he liked it more than I did. But I think we both can agree, and I think you can agree too. It is nice when you see these horror films and they go back to practical effects and
absolutely
actual impact. And I mean, obviously, there's a little bit of CGI assistance in a few moments, but for the most part, all the kills in the film, I'm pretty sure, were pretty much physical effects.
Yeah, it works. I think I liked it a little bit more than you. I wasn't blown away about it from it, but
I think it needed to be funnier. I think if it had been funnier, I think I would have liked it more. I think some of the humor, the little there is in there, falls flat. And, you know, Eli Roth is like that for me. Sometimes he lands and sometimes he falls flat on his face.
Yeah, but I like some of the touches he did, like the killer just feeding the cat before he leaves. You know, just these little quirks that happen.
That's a funny moment. And
it is. And yeah. And I wish – I agree with you. I wish I had more of that stuff. But for what it was, I kind of – I'm like, well, this is sort of an above-average slasher, and I had fun. And I'm with you. It's like, okay, you know who the killer is, but –
yeah,
it's more about getting to that reveal that I think works more than the reveal, but the reveal makes sense.
Yeah, on our scale, it'd probably be like a 6 to 6.5, somewhere in there. Like,
that's fair.
It's above average.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But not not the next coming, or not the...
Oh, Snow Warriors 2. I mean, come on.
It's not, yeah.
Like a 10, yeah.
That's an 8. Easy.
Got it.
That's also an inside joke for those who don't partake in our inside jokes.
Flat out 10, dude. I'm still upset about that.
I've never heard the end of this rating at Warriors 2 as an 8. I've never heard. If we do the 36 Chamber of Shaolin and I do 8 or lower, I'm never going to hear the end of it.
I'm burning your town down. Just burning it to the floor.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to discuss Roadhouse from 2024. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right. We'll be back right after this. Everybody, welcome back. So we are going to talk about a little movie that is making the rounds on the internet. So one of the great things I like about streaming services, and I don't think this is actually talked about enough, is it does make a film when it releases on a major streaming service. Now, it's not that you can't do this in a movie theater, but you really can't. I can't go see the talk show Devil film as quickly as people who live in a bigger metropolitan area. So one of the things I like about streaming is everybody can pretty much watch a movie on the same weekend. I do like that. The other thing about that is if you don't watch it quickly, the explosion of opinions is almost overwhelming.
Oh, you got to stay off social media or else something's going to get spoiled.
Yeah, I mean, it blows up immediately. People are watching it like midnight when it releases and like, boom, here's my review. And it's just, I mean, it explodes. I don't know how many people watch Roadhouse on Amazon Prime outside of the circles I run in. But the circle I run in, it was a lot. A lot of people.
I feel like everybody that I talk movies with had seen it on day one.
Right. So let me give it a little bit of a background here. Roadhouse, the original, the Patrick Swayze film, was a film that I saw as a young man, and you would have been similar in age. And when I first saw it, I liked it, but I thought, man, that is cheesy as hell. That's going to be a cult movie forever. And people were like, dude, that movie is not going to be a cult movie. People are going to forget about it. I'm like, that movie will never be forgotten. I promise you, it's just the right level of cheese. It will live forever. And I mean that in the most sincere way. If you ever want to go back and listen to one of my favorite reviews we've ever done, go back and listen to our Roadhouse review. I don't remember what episode it was. Forgive me. I don't have that information in front of me. But it was one of my favorite things we've ever done. And I love that film. I cherish it as much as some people cherish Citizen Kane or Deliverance, to keep it back to the Not a Bomb classics.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Entirely different film, but I get it.
Yes, yes, yes. So fast forward to about a year or so ago, they say they're going to remake Roadhouse with Jake Gyllenhaal and Doug Liman. Now, first of all, I like Doug Liman. I like Jake Gyllenhaal. So I'm in from the get-go. And I don't care. I'd rather they don't remake films. But the reality is, I understand it's a business. And it's been almost 30 years since Roadhouse came out, which is both heartbreaking and unbelievable at the same time.
Well, can we, if I remember correctly, that wasn't the first time a remake was announced. Like before.
Oh yeah, that's
right. Before Doug Liman, wasn't it Ronda Rousey was going to do the remake?
Yeah, I think there was. There's been several people attached to a remake, I think, over the years.
Yeah, I think Nick Cassavetes was going to like write and direct it with Ronda Rousey starring in it. And this was, I don't know, 8-7 years. It was farther back, not a full decade, but it had to be like 9 years ago or something like that.
Yeah. Feels like it. Well, when she was really hot, that would have been. I mean, that would have been close to 7-8 years ago. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Because when I first heard that, I'm like, okay, that's kind of interesting. I would have had the same reaction. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm with you on the Doug Liman, Jake Gyllenhaal thing. I'm like, I'm all in. The Ronda Rousey thing piqued my interest.
Yeah. I think it could have been interesting. But anyway, we'll leave that there. So let me go to kind of do some basic behind the scenes stuff and some basic conversation here to get us going. Ex-UFC fighter Dalton, this is bringing it into the modern era. So right away, with those four words, they're bringing you into the modern era. Ex-UFC fighter Dalton takes a job as a bouncer at a Florida Keys roadhouse, only to discover that this paradise is not all it seems. Which is, it's a weird synopsis because she promised him in the very beginning it's not what it seems. But
it's true. She was very open about it.
Yeah. This one stars one Jake Gyllenhaal, Daniela Melichoir. I don't know. She's very pretty, that lady. Conor McGregor. We'll talk a lot about him, mostly for some other reasons, but it's interesting. He's third billed. He doesn't really even show up in the film until an hour in, I think. Billy Magnuson, who's kind of fun and has kind of created quite a career for himself, really. He's in To Live and Die or whatever. I think the last James Bond film.
You're right. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Yeah. He's been in a lot of stuff. He's really kind of climbing the ranks. Jessica Williams as the bar owner, Frankie. BK Cannon as the bartender. Joaquin de Almeida, which is if there's a GGTMC actor as far as bad guys go, he's definitely one of them. He's been around a long time, and he's pretty good in this too, I have to say. Lucas Gage, a few other people pop up. One named Travis Van Winkle, great name. But I have to mention, this movie opens with some very slow motion shots of Post Malone fighting. I don't know how I felt about it, but I do know that I didn't feel like Post Malone could win those fights, but hey, you know what? I'm willing to go with it, right?
Yeah.
I'm willing to go with it. It's a movie. I'm going to go with it. I'll talk about a few other names. Basically just the cinematography, Henry Brahm, did the cinematography. I only brought him up because I think, if I'm not mistaken, he's the guy that did Guardians of the Galaxy 2 and 3 and a few other things. Oh, he did The Flash. So he works with Muschietti a little bit and stuff. Does a lot of comic book films. I think he's got a pretty good eye. And, I definitely think this film looks good. I'll say that. I think I'll leave it there. There's other names I can mention, but I'm going to leave it there. Let me ask you a couple. You like to do this on your podcast. I've always liked this about you because you're always the inquisitive one when you do podcasting.
Okay.
You're always the one that asks the questions. So I'm going to double down on you a little bit here.
Oh boy, I'm excited. Okay, yeah. Let's do this.
Doug Liman. What are your thoughts on Doug Liman?
I love Doug Liman.
Nice.
I do.
Nice.
100%. Now, I will say that with a caveat. I probably love half of his films.
Mm.
The other half I like a lot. But the thing I like Doug Liman the most, especially as sort of an action junkie, is he takes chances. Okay. And I think about, The Bourne Identity as a great example. When that thing sort of hit the scene, And his choices for doing the camera work in conjunction with the fight choreography, you could sit here and debate all day long, good, bad, indifferent, whatever. But for the time period when that hit, it was definitely different than what was on the mainstream. And I know you and I have sort of the same affection for a lot of Hong Kong style action choreography,
right?
And that's probably our preference. But you can't deny some of the visceral impact that there were some scenes in The Bourne Identity.
Mm.
And that's always what I've liked about him, is he shoots a film really well, and there's always going to be an aspect about it that he's willing to kind of do a little bit of experimentation.
Yeah.
But I do love his films. I love most of his films, but I really love him as a director.
Yeah. I was looking through his filmography before we started recording, and because I do like Doug Liman. I do think he's a very good filmmaker. I think it's the first thing I would have seen he did was Swingers, which was an indie darling. And I remember seeing that. But that doesn't really show the stylization as much of Doug Liman as the films that came after. I think what I found astonishing going back and looking at his filmography was Go was the next film I saw. And Go is a pretty good Pulp Fiction kind of riff. It really kind of feels like Pulp Fiction in some ways. And I like Go a lot.
And I think Go was the film where I kind of realized, like, hey, who is this guy?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Because I did remember Swingers, but I remember going to the theater and seeing Go and seeing it a couple of times and just really enjoying the energy that he had kind of put. And you can call it a Pulp Fiction clone all day long, but there's still an energy to it that is unique.
Yeah, I'd only call it a clone in the sense of story structure and, you know, kind of criminal elements. I think it stands on its own.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it definitely stands on its own. And it's probably the best kind of derivative of Pulp Fiction that I can think of, honestly.
Yeah, 100%.
For a film that's influenced by that. But anyway, after that, this is what shocked me. He makes Bourne Identity after Go.
Yeah.
So when Bourne Identity gets announced, I think to myself, well, they've never been able to pull those books off. They're going to have somebody special do it. They say Doug Liman's attached. And I'm like, look, I like Go. I like Swingers. But Doug Liman's not the guy. He's not going to be the guy to pull this off. Not that the books are action-packed, but they're selling this movie as this action movie. And I'm seeing the trailers, and I'm thinking, well, it looks pretty good, but still, it's Doug Liman. This is not his thing. And then I saw the movie, and I was like, holy shit, Doug Liman can do pretty much anything, it looks like. And then he, you know, from there he does Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which some people don't like that much. I quite enjoy it.
That's another I'd put in the love category. I really enjoy that film a lot.
Yeah. And then he has his first kind of like bomb in some ways with Jumper. He gets made fun of a lot for Jumper. And actually, I think Jumper's a pretty decent movie. I'd be interested if you guys ever cover that, of being on that episode.
We will cover it, because Jumper, we talked about this a little bit when we talked about Phantoms. Like, one of my favorite things of film is having this like goofy film logic or film science.
Yes.
And if it's interesting and they can stick to it consistently through the film, I really like that.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of sort of made up science and how it works.
Yeah.
But I really like directors who can go, hey, these are the rules, and I'm going to stick to them throughout the entire film and just see where it goes. And say what you will about Jumper, I think it's pretty entertaining, but I like that sort of pseudoscience aspect of it, and I think it's a pretty fun film.
Yeah, I think, you know, from there he does Fair Game. This is the one that I always get. I didn't see Fair Game. That's Sean Penn, Naomi Watts. I didn't see that film, so I don't know.
It's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It looks like a switch of gears from the action films he was making.
Mm-hmm.
And then he, I believe he does, is Edge of Tomorrow after that, or is there something in between?
I thought Edge of Tomorrow was after that. Because for me, that is his, that's his pinnacle.
And this is where I always take the hit, because I've still not seen Edge of Tomorrow.
Yeah, this is a problem, Sammy.
I don't know why.
Edge of Tomorrow is my favorite Doug Liman film.
Yeah.
I love it. Not just because it has Tom Cruise, which we all know how I feel about Tom Cruise. I wish Will were here so I could give him a lecture. But Edge of Tomorrow I just hits all the things I love about movies in terms of action, sort of the science fiction, the Tom Cruise-ness aspect of it. I think he really leans into the Tom Cruise movie persona. I love the monsters in that film. But Edge of Tomorrow, I find like one of his most thrilling films he did.
Yeah, I got to watch it. I got to watch it. Whatever reason, after Jumper, like my Doug, as much as I love Doug Liman, I really fell off watching his film. So I didn't see The Wall, which I heard was pretty good. I didn't see that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're gonna hate this too. I haven't seen American Made.
I know. I feel like you do this to make me mad. Where you're like Tom Cruise, Doug Liman. Nah, I'm not gonna watch that.
I know. It seems like I would watch it, but I know. I don't know. I don't know. Now, I didn't see Chaos Walking, but I've heard some interesting things about it. I know it's a book, and I know it's got some interesting dynamics, but that one was a bit of a – that one tanked for him as well, I'm pretty sure. And then in 2023, I think he made a documentary, which I have still not seen, and I'm kind of interested.
That's the Brett Kavanaugh sexual assault charges? Yeah.
Yes. I'd still like to see that one. Because it's secretly made, quote unquote. And I still haven't seen it, so I need to check that out. I don't know how you secretly make anything without being sued. But and then here he comes along with Roadhouse. And he's still working. He's actually trying to develop a sequel to Edge of Tomorrow called Live, Die, Repeat. That's actually kind of funny. He's working on a film right now, I believe, called Everest. Which I would assume, I don't know for a fact, but I would assume it's about mountain climbing. So in the 20s. So that's going to have Ewan McGregor and Juno Temple in it. So
yeah. Okay, cool.
So I'm looking forward to that because I think he'll bring something to that. And I'm just, you know, let's just put it this way. Anything he's going to do, I'm going to be somewhat interested in. He does have another film that is actually done called The Instigators. With Matt Damon and Paul Walter Hauser. Ooh, written by Casey Affleck and Chuck McLean. How about that?
Oh, okay.
That's interesting. Matt Damon, Paul Walter Hauser, Ron Perlman, Casey Affleck, Michael Stuhlbarg, Alfred Molina, Ving Rhames, Jack Harlow. Jack Harlow?
I'm in.
What the hell?
I'm in.
Anyway, you know, I'm in too. Follows two robbers who must go on the run with the help of one of their therapists after a theft doesn't go as planned.
Wow.
Well, that could be interesting. It's got Hong Chau in it too. How about
You know, he can do the comedy action genre pretty well. I mean,
yes, he does. I think that's why.
I think he knows how to blend it.
Yeah, Mr. and Mrs. Smith works quite well for that. I know. Again, some people kind of frown upon it now, but I still think that movie's funny and quite well done. Anyway, just want to kind of get it out there. Now I'll ask you the next question. How do you feel about Jake Gyllenhaal?
Well, after seeing Bubble Boy, I got to say I'm a pretty big fan of Jake as well. No, my son and I were talking about this because his age group talk about Jake Gyllenhaal quite a bit, which kind of surprised me. Hmm. And Cameron, he's my son, he's 18, he is in love with this guy. So the minute that he finds out Jake Gyllenhaal is in a film, we have to watch it. And that's what, you know, that's why we watched Bubble Boy, you know, last week.
And that's why you watched Roadhouse, outside of the fact that it was...
Well, we watched Roadhouse day one. Yeah. So as soon as we saw the trailer, Cameron's like, we're watching this day one. I'm like, absolutely. I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
And keep in mind, Cameron is not attached to the original source material as maybe I am, because you and I kind of had... You know, the same reaction to that film when it first came out. I didn't think it was going to be like a cult film, but I loved it. I was surprised how many other people kind of liked it. But, you know, we'll talk about the history of that because I think that's important when we talk about this film. But, you know, going back to your question about Jake Gyllenhaal, I absolutely think he's one of the best working actors out there today. So when you look at his filmography and the fact that he's pretty much done every genre for the most part, and no matter what you say about the film itself, I think you could walk away from each one of those films saying, at least Jake Gyllenhaal was really good in it. Mm. But I got to say, like, my favorite film of his still to this day is Nightcrawler.
Oh,
I think he's so it to me to play a dark character that's also really charming is probably one of the hardest roles to pull off and make it feel authentic. And that's why I love him in that film so much. It just feels natural.
Yeah.
And you don't see Jake Gyllenhaal. You see that character and you kind of despise him and you think he's slimy, but yet there's a little bit of a charm to him that you understand. You understand him. Yeah. He just feels authentic.
I do like him in Nightcrawler. I don't like the film as much as some folks do, but I do like him a lot in the film. He's very, very good. Mm-hmm. It's actually one I probably should rewatch again at some point, but for the most,
I think it's one on the second viewing. I probably fell in love with it a little bit more than the first viewing. First viewing, I was like, he's great. I really liked the film. But when I saw it again on home video after the theater, I think that's where I was just like, I really, really dig this film.
Yeah. I think what I like about Jake Gyllenhaal is, he takes chances. He really hasn't, when you think about his career, he really hasn't played it safe.
No, absolutely.
Bubble Boy is a risky film. I think it's funny. I think it's hilarious. I'm glad you watched it. I think it's also visually very interesting.
Yeah.
Donnie Darko was a risk.
My wife hates Donnie Darko and, but she's only seen it one time,
but you know, that's fine. It's that kind of film in my opinion.
It is, but that was, I think that's where Cameron's love of Jake Gyllenhaal came from.
Yeah.
Is I showed him that film and all of a sudden he became attached to it. But again, I'm kind of surprised his age group really kind of, gravitate to Jake Gyllenhaal so much.
Mm-hmm. I think about the back-to-back, films of Brokeback Mountain and Jarhead a lot.
Yes.
And how different he is in both of those films. And that's when I really started to take notice of him. Plus, after that, he follows that up with arguably one of the best films of the 2000 aughts, which is Zodiac. Which, you know, he's great in that film as well. And then, you know, it's just there's hits and misses after that. But I can't think of any of these films that I have seen that he is bad in. Like, there's films I don't love. But he is amazing in them. Everything from Source Code to Enemy, which was my favorite film of 2013. End of Watch, which I have some problems with. But, man, he's great in that film as well. I didn't see Prince of Persia, but everybody tells me I should check it out, that I probably like it a little bit more. Life, I like the performances in Life. I don't think it followed through with its ideas as much, but it was pretty decent.
Yeah. I think... There's something about that film that the fact that Jake Gyllenhaal is in it. I mean, Life has a really good cast with him and Ryan Reynolds and Rebecca Ferguson. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy that film. I don't know if I hate this term, like the film doesn't stick the landing. I think that is one where I sort of have a little bit of a problem with the third act.
Mm, yeah.
But I again, he's great in it. And I think it's a really great science fiction horror film.
Not entirely successful is what we say, right?
Not entirely. Yeah, I like that. But I mean, we've talked about him on Zodiac. We've talked a couple of Jake Gyllenhaal films. The ones that come to mind is Zodiac. Do what?
You talked about The Covenant.
The Covenant. Yeah. Guy Ritchie's The Covenant, which blew me away. Like I was kicking myself for not seeing that at the theater because I think that's one of the best films to come out of 2023, to be quite honest.
Yeah. I need to check it out. I still haven't got to it.
Yeah.
But you know, he works with Michael Bay right before that.
Oh, Ambulance. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Brad likes that film, and he says the reason why it's good is because of Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah. I mean, in 2022, going into 2023, he does Ambulance, A Voice in Strange World, which is a Disney misfire, and then The Covenant. And then he follows that up with Roadhouse. And he's got quite a bit of cool stuff on the books, but one of them being an untitled Guy Ritchie project. So we'll see. I guess Guy Ritchie and him had a pretty good time working together. So,
well, if he shows up on the credit, like he's going to be in this film, chances are, you know, my son's going to drag me there, but he's not really dragging me because a Jake Gyllenhaal film, I'm going. He is one of those actors that you can put his name on the poster and I'll be there.
Yeah. And he kind of gets, I think one of the things I like about him is he kind of gets his pick of directors at this point. Like he's in that really sweet spot with his career, where he can kind of he can kind of do whatever he wants right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he gets to work with whoever he wants, be it Michael Bay, Guy Ritchie, or, you know, being Mysterio in a Spider-Man film or whatever. He can do just whatever he wants right now. So
yeah, absolutely.
That's pretty great. All right. I'm going to leave it at those two. We could talk about other people in the film a little bit more, but probably not as deeply as we can talk about those two guys. So let's kind of get into this. What did you think of Roadhouse 2024?
Well, I have to say this, like one of the things, you shared your experiences with seeing the first Roadhouse.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a late 80s film. And I remember seeing it in the theater and coming out of the theater and going, that was a lot of fun. Like I knew even at a young age, it's like, that's not a great film. Like it's not a film that's going to rival Stanley Kubrick's work. Right.
Right.
But it definitely falls into this 80s Joel Silver action, boutique. And even at the time that it was released, I think it did pretty well at the box office. In fact, it had a pretty good run. And I'd read somewhere that overall, if you throw in all of its like home media income and everything else, at this point, it's made over like $200 million.
Yeah. Yeah. It's become quite the film.
Yeah. And deservedly so. But there was an interesting reaction when that came out. And even among my friends of that age group, where not everybody loved it. You know, some people were like, well, that was terrible. Other people kind of recognized what it was. And then some of us who just kind of fell in love with it was like, well, I don't know if the rest of the world is going to catch on to this, but I'll definitely be watching this like over and over again. Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I was going back and I was looking at some of the reviews and I thought this was interesting. So Roger Ebert at the time, when the original Roadhouse came out, had given it 2.5 out of 4 stars.
Mm-hmm.
But I found this quote and I thought it was pretty interesting. Roadhouse exists right on the edge between the good, bad movie and the merely bad.
Yes.
I hesitate to recommend it because so much depends on the ironic vision of the viewer.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a good movie, but viewed in the right frame of mind, it is not a boring one either.
I think that's a spot on and fair review.
Yes. That would be the review I would borrow for this version of 2024.
Okay.
Is it a good, well-made movie? I think it is. I think it's there. Does it check all the boxes of what made the original film so iconic? I think it tries. But yeah. To me, the secret ingredient of the first Roadhouse was Patrick Swayze.
Yes.
I think he is – now, you could say, you know, having a film that really, you know, goes behind the scenes on bouncer culture, mm-hmm. Having Jeff Healey, which is an amazing soundtrack,
mm-hmm.
Having Sam Elliott pop up, I mean, adds just this level to the film.
Yeah, which I think is a really interesting choice that they don't add that level to this film. They don't.
It is.
They don't give us a mentor character here.
They don't. And I appreciate the fact that they go in a different direction with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But to me, it all comes back to who are you going to have play that Dalton character? Because if you're going to do kind of a silly, out there, over-the-top action film, it only works if you can get behind that Dalton character.
Mm.
And the best thing that this film did was put Jake Gyllenhaal at the center of this thing.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
That is the true strength of the film.
It is. And, you know, at the end of the day, if you were to kind of go, well, where do you really land on it? I would say, well, okay, the film really makes a point throughout some dialogue to kind of go, hey, this is a modern Western, right? Which, the first Roadhouse probably touches in on that. But you have this roadside bookstore little kid who keeps, you know, making all these Western references to Dalton. And it does fit that. But if you were saying, okay, is Roadhouse more like Roadhouse or is it more like Walking Tall? I would go, it feels a little bit more like Walking Tall than it does like Roadhouse.
Yeah, I think this is a stranger comes into a strange town. is there to clean some things up. It doesn't Roadhouse, for whatever reason, 1987's Road. Is it 87 or 88? It's one of those years. That one feels like it's all about the kind of Zen dynamic of the Dalton character. The great thing about the Dalton character is he was one of the first badass characters I can recall in American cinema who was actually a pacifist.
Yeah.
But if pushed too far, he was the most dangerous man on earth, which was something that was pretty common in Asian cinema, but not really as common in American cinema. Most of our tough guys were pretty much tough guys on the tin, right? Like Sylvester Stallone, Arnold Schwarzenegger stuff. In comes Patrick Swayze and
off of Dirty Dancing, nonetheless.
Yeah.
Off which of was a year or two before. Yeah.
Off of Dirty Dancing. And, you know, here's this guy that comes along and he plays a tender yet vicious bouncer. It's what I love so much about it is it's the pacifist and the aggressor. It's that constant balance that also works in this film to its favor.
Yeah.
I think as we talk about this, I think the problem with this film is probably the problems with this film. And I don't think it's a bad film either. I agree with you. I think, you know, if I'm doing 4 stars, this is a 2.5. This is a entertaining romp. I had a good time with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there's a lot of problems with everything surrounding Jake Gyllenhaal. Some weird crocodile subplot.
Dude, right now, my fear of crocodiles. Like, this is why I don't like going to Florida. Those little ninjas, they can climb fences, open doors. If you go on YouTube and just like, hey, you know, type in crocodiles selling Girl Scout cookies, opening doors, those videos exist.
Yeah, no, they can get in houses, yes.
Yeah, it's nuts. So, yeah, that just reaffirms my fear of crocodiles. But I'm sorry, go on.
Yes. There's just some strange subplots. I don't think they need to keep going back to the UFC thing. I think one time's enough. I understand why they do it, but maybe that's a bit nitpicky on my part, but I don't think they needed to go back. I think you can get enough from the scene where he's telling the character that, you know, why did you do that to that guy? That guy was your friend. And that tells us that Dalton has a problem.
Yeah.
Which is something I kind of like about this version. The Patrick Swayze character is so in control of his anger that he can back out of it and be peaceful and do some Taekwondo, or not Taekwondo, but some
Tai Chi.
Tai Chi. There you go. Sorry.
Yeah.
Got him mixed up. But he can relax and everything else. This Dalton always feels like he's having a pretty bad day.
Well, I kind of agree with you. I mean, there's always this element that he's unhinged. He's so charming, but he's unhinged.
Yeah. He's tired. He's tired.
He is. And you almost feel like he's tired of keeping it in check.
Yeah.
And I love that aspect of his performance. And I love the aspect that, you know, it comes through at the end where, you know, he basically makes this comment where he's like, well, I'm not really the hero of this story. And, you know, the girl says, well, you know, you're not the villain either. Mm. And he comes to that realization. There is a little bit of a character development here, although subtle. Mm-hmm. But I love the fact what Gyllenhaal does with this character. He makes it so charming. But here's a guy that's just on his edge and he's tired of keeping it in check. And, you know, say what you will about the flashbacks, but they're timed in accordance to when he's just going to let loose and go, okay, I'm not going to keep this in check anymore.
Yeah. 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 I guess you could look at him that way, but I don't know. I just don't feel like I feel like I needed was the one. And I knew that this is a guy who, yeah, you picked to be a UFC fighter, but that doesn't mean that it's not possible that he could have PTSD from being that.
Sure.
He's living a lifestyle of violence, for a living. And competition, and you know, I feel like he could carry that with him the rest of his life, as I imagine most of those guys would.
Yeah, and it probably makes the cardinal sin of over explaining the backstory a little bit too much through the film.
Yeah,
to the point you get to the end of it and you go, okay, I get it. Like, this guy is super dangerous when yes. he is just going to let it, his demons out, right? I get that. Uh-huh. However, every time I start to feel like I'm just maybe in a bad soap opera, because there are elements that feel like that.
Mm-hmm.
There is always something that he does or says, or there's something bonkers that occurs that I just don't expect. And it pulls me back into just this fun action romp that it really is.
Yeah. Now, some of the complaints about the film that we have seen online are that some of the fights are CGI generated. I would say some of the fights are, although I never really felt like the Jake Gyllenhaal ones were to any degree. I felt like they felt pretty real. The Conor McGregor, we'll get to Conor McGregor here in a minute, but those fights felt good. Most of the Jake Gyllenhaal clearing and kicking ass felt pretty good. I think most of the CGI fight stuff that I really noticed is really in the beginning with Post Malone.
Yeah.
And that's probably there for a reason. I don't, you know, look, my son likes Post Malone. I like some of Post Malone's song. I get it. But, you know, a pit fighter, he does not strike me as.
Well, so here's the thing. And I even have to correct myself with this sometime, too. So I make no mistake. I am 100% the president of the Maryland chapter of the Jackie Chan fan club.
Yes.
I love my Hong Kong cinema. And I love the fact that, you know, you could go back in time from an action cinema perspective and say there was a time where people would put baby powder on their bodies for the sole purpose to show the audience that they're actually being hit.
Right.
Now, mind you, this is not in a Hollywood studio and most of these people were uninsured. Okay. But they're making films. They're making action movies. You come into 2024 in a studio and you get somebody like Post Malone who isn't a fighter. Okay. Yes, he doesn't have the physique of a fighter. He doesn't even know how to throw a punch for all intent and purpose.
Yeah. It doesn't look like it anyway.
It doesn't. And when you get a camera angle that wants to show you something and it says, okay, well, typically how they would do it in, let's say, old school fight choreography is you put the camera behind the guy that's getting punched so that you can clearly not even come close to his face, but it's all about selling the reaction to it. In this case, they're going to put the camera up front and we're not doing the baby powder and he's really going to hit him. But they're going to use CGI to maybe accentuate the punch or maybe show that it makes connection so you can see the blood and sweat and everything kind of splatter. Does it look good? Nah, not really. It's kind of cheesy, right?
Yeah.
Does it take away from that moment? Not necessarily. It No. doesn't really bother me because I know what it is. Now, if that stuff was being used consistently during some of these Jake Gyllenhaal fight sequences, I'd probably have a bigger problem with it.
Yeah.
But when it does occur, this sounds terrible. I think they're making the right choice of when to use that.
Right. Well, they use a technique. They called it I read about it some because I was kind of curious because I really only noticed it in the opening.
Mm-hmm.
After that, it pretty much feels like standard action choreography, not standard. I mean, I think some of the action, some of the fights are really good here.
Yeah.
But they called it a multi-pass technique.
Right.
To make them look a little bit more realistic. And I think in the process of doing that, because it's something we're not used to, I think it feels more fake than it was intended to feel. So whenever a director comes along and they're going to shake look, Doug Liman did this with, even though I don't think he's the first, I think Robert Rodriguez is really good at the handheld action stuff. And some people really hate that. And I get it. Some people hate what they call shaky cam.
The close quarter shaky cam combat.
Some people hate that, and I get it. It doesn't bother me that much. I don't suffer from motion sickness. So as long as it's done well, I'm okay with it. But I can understand why people don't like it. This one is another new technique, and I think Liman just wanted to try something different with the fight scenes. And I think it gives it a style that kind of stands out on its own. It's a little slick, but it's also very gritty and kind of visceral and nasty too.
Yeah, I'm glad you said those words because when I think about The Bourne Identity
mm-hmm.
and where people were either kind of taken aback because they felt that, okay, if you're going to champion that style of shaky cam and like the Bourne Identity, you're basically saying it feels like I'm in the middle of those punches, right? That they're being thrown back and forth.
Right.
And it kind of brings the viewer into the action. I think Doug Liman is trying to do that same thing with some of these sequences, which is why you get some camera movement in some key sequences to the point where it actually puts the viewer almost in a first person scenario where they're getting hit by those punches.
Yeah.
And I think it's effective. I think again, like, you know, when you ask me about Doug Liman, this is what I really love about Doug Liman.
Yeah.
We have very few directors or even action directors who are still trying to experiment. Now, you can say, doesn't work, didn't like it, didn't like the CGI, didn't like, you know, all of these other things. Great. That's just personal taste. However, I still think there are, you know, there are a lot of action sequences in here that work and are really visceral. You feel like you're in that moment. You feel the punches to a certain degree. And Jake Gyllenhaal and specifically Conor McGregor, they sell their fight scenes.
I mean,
they have two big fight scenes together, and I think they're quite fantastic, to be quite honest. I think they're really good.
I think they're good as well.
Yeah.
So let's just attack the elephant in the room here, because this for me has been the biggest part of this film. The two biggest things I've heard are the CGI fights.
Okay.
And the performance of one Conor McGregor. Now, Conor McGregor made a name for himself as a UFC fighter. He's quite the boisterous type, quite a character,
a hellraiser. He made a name for himself in the ring and out of the ring. Yes. And the incidents out of the ring. I mean, let's put our cards on the table here. Conor McGregor outside of the ring. Now, I would never say this to his face in person, but Conor McGregor outside of the ring is not a good person.
No. He's a jerk.
And if you were to go read the internet about all of the things that, and here's how it goes. He does something stupid. He's about to get arrested or go to trial. And then he reaches a settlement out of court.
Yeah.
That's his MO.
Yeah.
But he's still doing stupid things outside of the ring.
Yeah. He's not, for whatever reason, he's just not all there yet. Let's just put
I honestly he is unhinged as a real life person.
Yeah, I'd be curious what it was like working with him, to be honest with you. I'd love to hear a commentary track and hear what they say, because I have a feeling it had to be difficult in some ways. Anyway, needless to say, he shows up in this film, and I mean right from the get-go, Troy, and I know you know what I'm gonna say. Right from the get-go, the film's tone changes in a lot of ways.
Yes.
Before that, there's a few comedic moments, but I think this is a bit of a controversial choice, but I mentioned it on Facebook, so it's not that I'm making this up now. This is one of those performances that I don't know if I'll ever be able to wrap my brain around. I both hated it and loved it at the same time. It is one of the most ridiculous bad guy performances I have seen in quite some time. There's this cartoonish walk. We get to see a lot of his ass.
Well, can we talk about that cartoonish walk for a second?
Yeah, we can, because there's a lot of it.
Yeah, he enters a room. So if you've ever played with like a, I don't know, G.I. Joe action figure, a He-Man action figure, and they have the kung fu grip or their fists are closed.
Yeah.
And if you were to simulate an action figure walking and you were to just move it with your fingers, basically the upper body and the arms are all in the same position. Now, the legs may move,
yeah,
but really the torso and the arms are just swinging left to right as he walks in.
He has the pivot abdomen. The pivot abdomen.
Yeah, absolutely. But he is rigid and stiff from like the waist up. And when he walks, I mean, it can just go left and right. But if you were to kind of go, well, I hate the CGI, I'm like, are you talking about Conor McGregor's walk? Because it almost looks like that it's just a CGI walk for all intent and purpose. But it's memorable.
So that's the thing, right? I mean, I think what you have to remember is we've gotten so used to our bad guys. There's been a lot of great bad guy heavy performances over the last 20 years. That's not to give an excuse here, but I think one of the things we miss sometimes, I think this same criticism, in my opinion,
And some people are going to go, you know, they're going to clutch their pearls when I say this. But I remember, was it, I can't remember which, was it Skyfall? Javier Bardem's performance?
Oh, yeah.
Remember how over the top that was? And some people just did not like it at all. They were like, ugh, why did he, you know, after coming off one of the great bad guy performances with the No Country for Old Men, then he goes into this kind of flamboyant, kind of way over the top thing. Look, Conor McGregor was never going to win anything here to begin with. This is the first time he's been in a movie that I'm aware of. And it was going to be tough for him no matter what. The key thing, though, even though he's very cartoonish and very silly, I still think he makes an excellent foil and he brings an energy to this film when it needs some energy.
1,000% agree.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to go on the record here and say you've got Roadhouse, a 2024 remake of a film from the 80s who was nominated for just about every Razzie Award that was out there.
Yeah.
It is a pure macho 80s film. And they're coming in and saying, okay, we're going to remake that and update it. And the thing that I really appreciate this film just a lot is they really latch on to, I think, some of the goofy and silly over-the-top aspects of the villains and go, okay, you got Billy here who starts out as your heavy. So he's the heavy in the first part of the film, right? And he's kind of over-the-top but a little subdued. He has this whole shaving on a catamaran sequence that's kind of just kind of silly. But yet it's kind of, I don't know, it's kind of effectively funny, but it matches the tone of this film.
Yeah.
And just at the hour mark, when you're like, okay, so far, everything that this, Ben Brandt character has thrown at the Roadhouse, it's not working. Yeah. Right. And I want to talk about one of the henchmen at one point, because I think he's a highlight of the film. But, okay. I mean, Dalton's just taking care of everything. And you're like, okay, you need somebody who's going to go up against this UFC fighter. And Jake Gyllenhaal brings this sort of, I don't know, I don't want to call it a dark charisma. He's very charismatic, but you know he's unhinged, right? But he's just keeping it under, you know, a little bit.
Yeah.
If you're going to have him go up against somebody in the third act, you got to bring a villain that is more unhinged and just more out there in terms of presence to actually highlight how smooth, calm, charismatic that the Dalton character is.
Yeah.
And I think that's where Conor McGregor really nails it, because it feels like Conor McGregor was reading stuff about UFC Conor McGregor and going, oh, I'm going to play that guy. And then doing almost a interpretation or, I don't know, a parody of his online Conor McGregor presence.
Yeah.
There's a running joke that every time he gets in a car, he wrecks it, which I think is kind of funny.
Well, I think that's the other thing about the movie. I think it's so I think the energy it brings is humor.
Yeah, absolutely. Sammy, I laughed quite a bit during this film. And I got to tell you, you get to that final fight sequence between them.
Yeah.
And the best line out of the entire film is they do this crazy like speedboat thing. And all of a sudden Jake Gyllenhaal and Conor McGregor stand in this boat. Conor McGregor's like swinging this weight around. He's like, ah, look at us. We got our own little octagon. And Jake Gyllenhaal's response is, who taught you shapes? I mean, our entire family was busting out rolling, but it's an example. I mean, they're destroying this bar and he's smashing Jake Gyllenhaal's head in a piano.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, I think the piano's out of tune. I mean,
I know
that is exactly what this film needed.
It is, because I think it would have been just too overwrought and serious otherwise.
Yeah. It 100% knows when to not take itself seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And that Conor McGregor performance encapsulizes that whole Roger Ebert review of, I don't know if it's so bad or it's good or if it's just plain bad, but my goodness, is it memorable. And it actually is so fascinating to watch. And I've watched this film twice now. And I got to say, after you get through the initial shock and you go, okay, I see what they're doing here. I don't have Jeff Healey music. I don't got the Sam Elliott mentor. I got a little bit more of a backstory with the Dalton thing. The humor's still there. The over-the-top quality is there. The fight scenes were okay. Go back and watch it a second time and now just kind of go, I know what I'm getting into from that perspective.
Yeah.
And I got to say, I had a lot more fun with that second viewing. I liked it the first time.
Uh-huh.
But I started to fall in love more with Dalton, and I really started to fall in love with that Knox character.
Yeah.
Because say what you will, that is a great villain for this type of film.
Yeah. We have said this over the years on this show. You got to have a good heavy to go along with your hero. You just got to have it. And they could have taken the serious route, but Conor McGregor's not that actor.
No,
he's not that guy.
And I'm glad that he's not a good actor either.
Yeah. You needed him to be what he is in this. That's what you needed him to be. I don't think Marshall Teague is completely cartoonish in the original Roadhouse. And nobody seems to mind that.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, he's completely cartoonish. Go back and look at the original Roadhouse. He acts like he's a werewolf.
No, you're right. But that's what that movie felt like. I think, don't get me wrong, the original Roadhouse is fantastic. But I will also say I watched the sequel and I had fun with that one too. Now, I think this 2024 version is a huge improvement over that sequel that they did.
Mm.
But I got to tell you that as a remake or a reboot, it really does capture to a certain extent the charm of the first one. Is it successful at every step of the way? No.
No.
Probably the best analogy I can think of is one of the greatest things I like about the first film is Jeff Healey. Like the music in the background, every time they go to the Roadhouse, he's one of my favorites, right?
Yeah, it's obviously in Roadhouse it's a lot better. Although I will say the music is not bad in this version either.
It's not bad, but to give you an example, the music is a bit all over the place because
it's kind of just background.
The very first artist you get is Natalie Bergman. Now she's good, right?
Uh-huh. Yes.
But you go from like Natalie Bergman to the Zydeco Twisters, Jelly Joseph band, and then one of the last performers you get is like CeCe Adcock, who's fantastic. But it's an example of there's a little bit of a tonal shift in the music that's going on in the background where I think this film has that problem every once in a while, right? It wants to be a Western. It wants to be sort of this melodramatic 80s cheesy action fest. Then it takes itself a little too seriously. And I think when Conor McGregor comes in, and maybe I'll catch some shit for this, but I actually think the movie finds its footing at the hour mark and it knows exactly what it is. And it leans into it as soon as that Conor McGregor character shows up.
I think so. It becomes the movie that I think it wanted to become most of the way through. And, look, our good friend Mike, who's on Facebook, we both comment on this. I agree. It's not a great performance, but it's the performance that the film needed. And it's as much as Conor McGregor at this point in his acting career. It's probably as much as he can give. And I'm okay with that. I think
I am too. I would say it's not a great performance from a acting technical perspective, but I will say it is a great performance for a Roadhouse film.
Yeah. Does he even wear a shirt in the film? Now that I think about it.
He does. Yeah.
I think he does at some point, but yeah.
I mean, it's always, he's always got it open to some degree and it shows the tattoo, but
yeah.
I mean, my goodness, I've never seen a man's ass that much in a film before. And you see it all over the place in this thing.
Yeah. And there's a fun little tidbit with the, there's a post-credit sequence. It's kind of fun too.
Yeah. I didn't mind that either. I know some people are kind of complaining about that and I'm like, well,
that's the point of the character. Yeah.
Yeah. Why would you not want to see these two people like show up in a sequel?
Yeah. Why would you not? I would love for Jake Gyllenhaal to be like, oh my God, you again?
Yeah.
Now, here we got, looky here, we got our own little octagon. Man, has anybody taught you shapes?
You still don't know your shapes.
Yeah. When I came away from this, first of all, so this is the confusing part. I only watched it the one time. But when I came away from this the first time, I thought, wow, they really went forward with the Conor McGregor thing. It's not entirely successful, but bravo, they gave it a shot.
Yeah,
Doug Liman is way too talented a director not to know what he's doing there. He knows he's got a cartoonish performance. That's what he's going for.
Oh, he leans into it.
Yeah.
I really think there's an exchange between the Knox character and is the Brad, whatever the preppy
Brent
son. Brent. Yeah.
Rasmussen or whatever his name is.
Yeah. When he shows up and Connor's like, no, I'm taking that bedroom and I'm doing this, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that's a great moment.
Again, it's not great acting from him in that perspective, and you almost feel like Billy. The actor is like, what do I do with this scene? Like, he almost looks a little confused. And I think it works. Like, there's something there where there's almost a disconnect between those two actors in terms of talent and caliber, that it works in the context of what's going on in this film.
Yes, I agree with you. I agree with you completely. I think that if I have problems with the film, honestly, for me, it's just, I don't understand. The crocodile thing is a great moment, but I don't understand why they put it in there and then just kind of drop it. I do like the one fun. You wanted to talk about one of the henchmen. Which one of the henchmen was it?
Arturo Castro.
Oh, the comedic one. Yes.
Yeah, I think he's fantastic.
He is pretty good.
Yeah, again, but it fits the tone. It's almost like as things are getting super serious, here's this guy in the back that is like just adding this commentary to it, yeah. and it breaks the ice a little bit. I mean, and he almost steals all the scene that he's in. Like when Conor McGregor is busting out the he shows up at the Roadhouse with that golf club and he's tearing everything up, and Dalton goes past the Arturo Castro character, and Arturo's holding this chair up and he's like, oh, hey guy, you know, how you doing? Good to see you. You know, as he's going, you know, to like smack some guy.
Yeah.
So I like all of a sudden that out of their initial reaction when he takes him to the hospital and throughout the rest of the film, it's almost like this Dalton character and this henchman character have created this nice little bond of niceness, which was, you know, sort of a running joke in the first film. You've got this henchman that's being super nice to Dalton, which feels like a callback to the very first Roadhouse with the whole be nice speech.
Uh-huh.
Now, I know that's a stretch.
Yeah.
But it to me, it's a nice way to kind of bring that theme out to a certain degree within like these two character exchanges.
Yeah. I quite liked it. I really did. At first I was like, oh, this isn't going to work. We got this funny henchman, but the things he says are pretty funny.
Yeah, hey, I like riding bikes and there's not a lot of people to ride, you know. thanks for not doing the violence.
Yeah, thanks for not doing the violence. But also in saying that, you know, the movie has comedy throughout. Not only does it have that, but actually the Billy Magnuson, I think that's his name, character, the Ben Brandt character, he's funny as well because he's this spoiled brat. And I love the constant comeuppance of his character. I love the way he's just, you know, constantly kind of pissed on even by his own henchmen. And the moment where his dad calls, and I think it's a great idea too, to keep the dad secret. Like they never show us who the dad is. He throws his phone in the water and then he tells that guy to go get his phone.
but again, I mean, for the first half of the film, he's great as like the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you get an hour of Billy and his henchmen, and they really just can't crack the code on this Dalton character. So you need that Knox character to come in and up the ante.
Yeah, you do. And you also need, and I think is actually kind of smart about the film, is you need the Ben Brandt character to hate the Knox character as much as the Dalton character does.
Oh, I love, as you know, when Ben and Knox first meet, and he's like, I got a message from your dad, and he just pops him in the eye. He's like, that's fantastic. There's just this whole
that actually comes back later on with one of Brandt's henchmen punching Jake Gyllenhaal in the face, and Jake Gyllenhaal just barely reacting.
Yeah. I'm telling you, Sammy, the more we talk about this film,
it's funny.
I just want to watch it again.
It's a funny movie.
It is, but it's not just a funny movie, but it's a fun film.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really do think like the one of the appeals of Roadhouse, and maybe this is a guy thing, although I don't know if that's true because my wife loves the first film and she really liked this new one too.
Did she? Good.
But there's something about having these sort of action comedies who I think it knows what it's doing. It leans into those elements. And you could, you know, my only gripe is maybe it takes 30 or 45 minutes to kind of find its footing.
Yeah.
Where it goes, okay, this is really what we're going to do. And then it just goes with it.
Yeah.
But it's just a fun film. Like to me, if anybody complains about this, but yet loves American Ninja or loves Commando or any of the 80s films or anything from Michael Dudikoff in the 80s, yes. to me, it's like those are not great films, but they're certainly fun. And they know what they are and they lean into it and you can appreciate those and just go along for the ride. And I really think that this fits the bill.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I had a good time with it. I probably, you know, talking with you about it, I probably liked it more than I thought the first time. I definitely had problems with it. I do think it's too long.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely too long.
I think, you know, the crocodile elements are just, it's just needless. Although that one moment is terrifying. Yeah. I think that it just take, I mean, the character, the Doc Master, he's like, you think he's going to be like this Zen-like character. He's there for like two scenes and then he's gone. There's just some weird stuff that I think they kind of open up and then they just drop it. And I think that's kind of odd. So I don't think it's certainly not perfect, but is it entertaining? Yes. I think the fight scenes work. I think the performances work. I think it all works. And I think, again, we talk about a whole genre of cinema where the bad guy is a cartoon, and that's called Eurocrime. And Tomas Milian would have been the Knox character in the 70s.
Oh, my God. That is a great comparison. Yes.
He would have been that character.
Yeah.
Because if you go like and look at Tomas Milian's performances, they're almost always cartoonish and over the top. And that's why I love him so much, because he's just – he was never afraid to go for it. He was just going to be like, well, I'm just going to wear a wig and smoke a cigarette with a cigarette holder and do it, you know, and I'll do something.
Yeah.
And, you know, he just always brought it. He always brought some energy to the film. When a film typically needed it the most, he'd bring it. And that's what I feel like McGregor's doing here. Not even close to the level of acting ability that Tomas Milian has. Not even close. Don't get me wrong. I don't think Conor McGregor's a great actor, but I do think what he is asked to do, and Doug Liman is a smart enough filmmaker that is exactly what he knew would give the film a bump in the second half, because literally he shows up like right at the hour
point. At the 1 hour mark. Yeah.
Yeah.
And jumping out of a window, yeah, butt ass naked.
Yeah. And the movie, the movie changes.
It does.
The movie changes. Like the energy just goes way up.
Yeah. I think I'm really liking this movie more and more that we talk about it, because I do think the first hour does a great job of establishing the Dalton character as sort of that iconic stranger coming into town to clean it up.
Uh-huh.
And I don't want to say it plays it safe, but it really leans heavy into Jake Gyllenhaal's ability for you to like that Dalton character, even though you think there's a sketchy past to it, right?
Yeah.
And the only way you're going to like him and maybe appreciate his level of violence is to bring that Knox character in at the hour mark.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I really don't have much more to say about the film. I don't know if you do as well, but I mean, you got anything else you want to add?
No, I mean, well, there is one thing. So you do get a little bit of a romantic angle or subplot. Oh, yeah.
We should talk about that. I mean, we shouldn't poo-poo it, because it is there.
It is, and I gotta say this, I actually like the resolution of it.
I do. I liked it. I typically don't like the kid as the all-wise storyteller. But I like this one. I like this child actress. I liked her. I like the Fred the Tree joke, and I like the fact that she ties it back to a Western. That she's seeing a Western unfold in front of her very eyes, and Dalton's like, whatever.
Yeah, it works, but, you know, the romantic relationship and how it ends. And I got to say, I really appreciate the fact that after all of that violence, and you know, she walks up into that bar and sees what he just did and the look she gives him, I'm like, okay, that was good. Like I really like where that relationship goes.
Yeah. I like all that posturing he does in the first half. I like,
yeah.
Do you guys got insurance? Like what?
How far is the hospital?
Yeah, how far is it? 25 miles? Okay.
Arturo's in the back's like 20, 25 minutes. and even that sequence where, you know, he just got his butt handed to him and he sees all his friends on the ground and he's like, all right. And then he rushes towards him and he gets his arm broke. Again, yeah. Even the fight, this is the thing about the fight sequences. They're fun. I think they're, and I'm talking about the Jake Gyllenhaal ones, not the Post Malone. They're fun. I think the camera angles work in this event. I think from a technical aspect, they're really good too. There's an exchange on the back end where Jake Gyllenhaal like just punches Conor McGregor super low, which brings Conor's body down so that he can do the uppercut.
Yeah.
Because I've seen this thing twice and I've watched those fight sequences. From a technical aspect, they're brutal.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel real, like the exchanges aren't, don't get me wrong, I love my flippies in a Hong Kong film and all that other stuff.
Sure.
But if you're going to do a UFC fight, you want it to be messy. And I like that some of those exchanges between those two, especially in the first encounter and then the final showdown, there's a messy quality to it, but the camera makes it still look good.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you. Yeah, I think, you know, talking about it tonight, I've only seen it the one time. But I have to say, yeah, I mean, it's not a bad movie. It's not. Is it a masterpiece? No. Could it be, you know, some people aren't going to want to hear this. They're going to say, oh, my Lord, I can't believe you said that. But could it be this generation's Roadhouse? I mean, it could be.
I think so. Like, I think it's funny. When you and I discovered Roadhouse, we're in our teens.
Yeah, I would have been 14 or 15.
Yeah, same. And we fell in love with it instantly, right? And it's something that we've gone back to as comfort food.
Mm-hmm.
And something we enjoy watching.
It is the ultimate cupcake of a movie. I mean, it is.
Yeah, and I 100% watching Cameron's reaction, so my 18-year-old son, to this film, because he's a huge Jake Gyllenhaal fan, I can totally see him like 15, 20 years from now going, oh my God, I love Roadhouse. And everybody's going to assume the Patrick Swayze one. He's like, no, the Jake Gyllenhaal one.
And
he's going to have the same reaction to this one that we would have had, you know, to the Patrick Swayze one.
Yeah, it's true. Also, I just want to say Jake Gyllenhaal is only 44. I don't know why I thought he was probably closer to our age, but he is not. He's only 43 or 44 years old. And looking and finding that out again was, I don't know why, but it shocked me.
He's pretty damn dreamy. I mean, yeah. I got to say, he looks great in this one.
I thought that. I was like, whoa. I mean,
yeah, I was like, whew, I'm sweaty right now. Yeah, that's fantastic.
Phenomenal shape in this film.
Yep.
Definitely. All right, let's get into make or breaks and MVTs. What do you got?
I guess if we're going with the make or break, I've got to go to the the first time you get to see the Dalton character in action with the slapping, and the whole, is there a hospital around? Yeah. But it's not even that. So as fun as that is, what is the icing on the cupcake, since we're using that analogy, is when he is driving them to the hospital and they're all in that car. And they're just sitting there and he goes, bump. And then they hit a bump and they all just start moaning. That I think that was the scene that all of a sudden I was like, I am in. I'm 100% in. After that little beatdown and sort of the comedic element that happens after it, I was sold on the film at that point.
Yeah. So I can't argue with you on almost anything Jake Gyllenhaal does in the film. Almost all those moments are good, including, even though I think it doesn't really belong in the film, including the crocodile subplot scene, which is fun in a bizarre, horrific moment.
Yeah.
It's like, what the fuck? What are we watching? But I am going to go out on a limb because I'm going to go back and forth on the make or breaks on this one. I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's the first time Conor McGregor shows up with the Ben Brandt character. Because I laughed so hard when he punched him in the nose.
Yeah, it's so good.
And I rewound it like 6 times. Like, I couldn't stop fucking laughing. I was dying. Yeah, but dad's got a message for you. And just real quick.
And he's eating a sandwich. I love that aspect of it.
Dude, that is like Naked Gun funny. I mean, that is like I couldn't stop laughing at it. And like I said, to a lesser extent, that henchman on the boat later on, when Jake Gyllenhaal gets on the boat, he hits him, and Jake Gyllenhaal's just like, you know, really? He didn't even hurt. I mean,
there's so many. Oh, God. Yeah.
And then it's hilarious when Conor McGregor hits him, the look on his face, and Conor McGregor just kind of walks off with that walk.
Yeah.
That room up there, that's going to be mine. Yeah, I'll take that one. I think I'm doing an Australian accent. I don't know what I'm doing. But, yeah, I never thought I'd give a make or break to Conor McGregor. But, I mean, I'm sorry, man. That moment's gold. And, again, if you don't think Doug Liman knows what he's doing with an amateur actor, but a personality, he knows exactly what he's doing.
Oh, yes, 100%. Yeah. I agree with that.
He knows exactly. Okay, MVT then. What you got?
I'm going Jake. This hinges on that Dalton character. I've got to be honest. I am this close to saying Conor McGregor. But he didn't deliver that "who taught you shapes" line, which had me on the floor. But if you don't love Jake Gyllenhaal, when you watch this film, you're going to love Jake Gyllenhaal. I think he's fantastic in this film.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I could go Doug Liman, but I think I'm going to go Jake Gyllenhaal because Doug's done some other great stuff. Jake's done some great stuff too, but this is a chance for Jake to shine. I mean, this is a movie star making role. Not that he needs it. He's already had a few, but this is him using the gravitas of his stardom.
Yeah.
And Doug Liman knowing what he's got. I mean, Doug Liman knows he's not making high art here. He knows he's making a fun, rambunctious action movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I think people need to get on board with that to a certain degree. I'm not going to sit here and say that anybody who doesn't like this film, they're just wrong about it. I mean, you like what you're like.
Yeah,
right?
There's things to not like about it. I agree with that.
Absolutely. And any of the criticisms I've seen, I don't negate any of that.
And look, I even agree with our friend Mike and stuff. If you can't get behind the Conor McGregor performance, sure. I totally understand.
It's really going to spoil your enjoyment of the last hour of the film.
Yeah, because it's completely off the wall. I mean,
it is. And for somebody to come in and say, well, I liked the first part, but man, I just didn't like the second part for that Conor McGregor. Totally understand it. Totally. However, I think you gotta borrow Doug Liman's perception on this one and go, man, we're making a film called Roadhouse.
Yeah. It's a bar film set in the Keys.
It's a bar film. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, did anybody see the original Roadhouse? That's
probably because it's pretty damn close.
That's probably what he probably said. I do think the film, for me, I did like the Sam Elliott character quite a bit in the original. And I do kind of wish there would have been, like, it would have been great if they'd have brought some, like, older action star in, like a surprise stunt casting of some sort.
That would have been great if they brought Don Lee in, man. Come on.
Yeah. Oh, that would have been amazing. But I never would have bought that. Don Lee wouldn't have kicked everybody's ass over. Well, maybe I would have, but yeah, I would have. But I mean, you know, Sam Elliott's got that great moment in the first one where he kicks that guy in the knee and he's like, oh, that hurts, doesn't it?
Yeah. But even in the first one, there's that whole monster truck sequence. Benny the Jet Urquiza's in the background, like cheering.
That, I mean, that is absolutely ridiculous. Like,
yeah. And you're like, why is that even there? Well, there are some scenes in this new one that replicate that same, like, what the hell's going on kind of thing.
Yeah, you could argue that the crocodile is the monster truck of this movie.
You could, because it just comes out of nowhere. You're like, oh, okay, all right, that happened.
Yeah, Let's move on. Are we watching a horror film all of a sudden? Like,
yeah.
And everybody keeps, there's a funny joke there. Crocodiles hide their food, and he's like, do they teach people that in elementary school around here?
Yeah, it's like, they're never going to find that body.
It's disturbing. All right, score out of 10.
Oh boy.
I'm always nervous when you come on the show because you are the kindest scorer I know.
I'm the most accurate. Okay, let's just put that out there. Enter the Ninja, 10. Okay, Revenge of the Ninja, 9.5 or 7.5. Can't remember. I'll say this. When I first saw this film, and if we had talked after my first showing, I would have been like, okay, this is probably a 6.5, 6.75. Watching it a second time and then having a great time talking with you about it, I got to be honest, I really find this just falling into that 7.25.
Nice.
That's where I would put it. And I also have to be honest, I could see myself like when you visit or I visit you or you, Brad, Jose, and I are just sitting around and we were to watch this again. I could see it going up another like 0.25 to a 7.5 territory.
Oh, yeah. With like-minded folks, this would be a great group watch.
Yeah, I got to say, after my second viewing and having this conversation, I'm probably going to land at a 7.25.
Yeah, nice. That's a totally fair score. I've only seen it the one time, and even that one time, I landed somewhere between 6.5 and 7. And my thoughts were, what's going to take me to 7? And honestly, talking through it here again, it's the same thing. It's the same thing I think that was going to get me there anyway. And I'm going to give it a flat 7. I can't disagree with the 7.25. It's totally fair. But I think that there's some fat on the bone here, but Conor McGregor and Jake Gyllenhaal on the second half of this raise this thing up and just kind of hold it there and really bring it to what I wanted the whole film to be.
Yeah.
And there's just so much comedic moments in here that are so good. Yeah, I'm going to go 7. I could see myself going 7.5. Maybe, I know this might be blasphemy, maybe even getting up in A territory in the future.
Yeah, only if Warriors 2 gets pushed up can you give this one an 8.
I knew that was going to, that's part of the reason why I said that. So you.
I know, you do it every freaking time.
Oh, man. No, it was fun talking about this one. This one was a lot of fun. I hope people check it out. And, I know there's some experimental stuff going on here, and it might not be for everybody. That's fine. But I think that there is a lot of good here. And I think Doug Liman is smart enough to know what he's doing.
I think so, too. We have really good friends who just do not like this film. And I get it.
Yeah, I get it too.
Totally get it. And I think they're all valid concerns. I just, for me, I really hope people don't get turned off by anything negative from this, perspective or what they read, and just give it a chance. I mean, even when I see scores on Metacritic or, from professional reviewers versus the armchair, they're always landing in that 6 or 7 territory. And I think that's pretty accurate for this film.
Yeah.
However, I 100% feel like 15, 20 years from now, somebody's going to come back and go, hey, this was a fun little 2020s, that decade's action film.
Yeah.
And it's going to get a lot of love in the future. Probably not to the cult status that the original got, but I do think there's going to be a, the 14 or 15 year olds that discover this thing, and they're going to latch onto it for a very long time.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think the first one's just got so many bizarre moments that it almost can't be overtook because it's just so out there.
If you're talking, what are some of the perfect films that really exemplify the 80s? The original Roadhouse is in that discussion.
It is. It really is. All right, man. That's the show. You want to say anything else about Not a Bomb before we get off here?
Listen to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema first. That should always be the very first thing you listen to. Yeah. If you end up having any time left in your schedule throughout the rest of the week, then go listen to Not a Bomb. But, man, if you're short on time and you go, well, I can only do one podcast, it's always Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. So that's my recommendation.
All right. I do appreciate the compliment. I don't know Will does as well. But make sure to check out Watch Skip Plus if you want to listen to some new movie reviews. They're always fun. Mary with Clickers, so many people. I don't have the list in front of me. Rares of the Podcast, See Here Podcast, love this album. There's so many. Night of the Living Podcast.
You and Will have built up an amazing community.
Yeah. Of those, I feel like we've inspired most of those folks.
Absolutely.
Although I will say Night of the Living Podcast, those guys inspired. They're part of the reason why I even do this. So,
hey, can we mention something real quick? So if sure. you follow Night of the Living Podcast, Kelly has kind of done a semi-retirement over there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I just want to – when I think about my introduction to podcasts or even this community – it really came about from the Night of the Living Podcast folks. And Kelly was one of the first people I met.
Mm.
And he was the one who introduced me to you and Charlie and Brad and everybody else.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I know Kelly's kind of doing some extra side projects. And he's coming back to Night of the Living Podcast like off and on versus doing the regular stint.
Right.
But I got to say, it did kind of break my heart when I heard that news because he's one of the OGs.
Yeah.
But I totally understand it. But I do want to put that out there that, you know, without Kelly, I would not have met this amazing community that you and Will have built, as well as what, you know, Freddie, Amy, Andy, and Kelly built over at NOTLP.
Yeah, as open as we are, I still can't believe the first time I met the NOTLP guys, how immediately they just took me in.
Yeah,
it's unbelievable. And how even if I don't see them every year, like they will be the first ones to invite me to their house, to spend time together, to do anything. Like it's like family you never leave. So I can't say enough nice things about them. Amy and Freddie and Andy and even Erica and Chizik when they were on, and
yes.
Kelly and all those guys. They were just wonderful. And they even let me I was on an episode of that show talking about Madman. I just hit them up and I was like, I'd love to be on the show sometime and talk about Madman. They're like, come on up. And I'm like, come on up. They're like, yeah, come on to the house. Let's do it. And I got to sit in their house and do a review. It was an amazing experience. I don't know if it's out there on the internet anymore, but it was an amazing experience. I probably sound like I'm lost.
No, but again, I mean, it's that type of personality or that type of group just kind of attracts, like-minded people.
Yeah.
So, you know, I tell you and Will this all the time, and I know Brad and Jose, everybody feels the same way, but we're so thankful for all of the years that you guys have put into this, and especially all the time and effort. I don't think people understand how much time and effort go in behind the scenes,
yeah.
But it's super appreciated. And I know you guys do this not for like the fortune and glory, but more so for the community and the friendship.
Yes.
And maybe
just a smidge of glory.
Maybe just a smidge of glory. But yeah, I just am so appreciative for all of the things that you guys do.
Yeah. I can tell you this, man, and not everybody knows what I've been through, but my closest friends have. Thank God for having a podcast family. Let me tell you that.
Yeah.
Thank God.
No,
it got me through a lot this past year.
Yeah.
Definitely did. So remember. I just said this the other day to people. Somebody posted something online, and I said, if anybody listens to our show, I am your friend. Because if you bother to listen to us, I'll open my door to you anytime you want to.
Oh, absolutely.
So, anyway, that's the big show, man. I don't know when. I don't know what we'll be doing when we come back. I mean, the plan is to do Disconnected, the horror film. When we come back, but I don't know if Will's going to be available or not. He's got some stuff going on. If not, I'll figure it out. I'll put something out. But I want to thank everybody for listening. And with that, I will say, and Troy, I want to thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for pinch hitting, so to speak.
Of course.
As a fellow baseball fan, you know exactly what I mean.
That's right. Yankees suck. Go Cubs.
Can't say pinch hitting to Jose. He's like, what? Yeah, and I heard that too. I'm choosing to ignore that.
That's fine. All right.
I will say adios.
Adios.
Thanks for listening. You can find the gentleman at ggtmc.com, and you can email the gentleman at midnightcinema@gmail.com.